From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we feature interviews from our archives with writers who have new books or new editions of old books. Poet Philip Levine talks about what work is. He has a new memoir. Grace Paley reads one of her poems, talks about the old neighborhood, and reflects on her years as a peace activist. Her three volumes of short stories have been collected in one book. And Kurt Vonnegut remembers being a POW in Dresden, Germany, when the city was firebombed. It's the basis of his novel Slaughterhouse-Five, which has just been published in a new edition. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews a telemovie starring Kirstie Alley. And we remember filmmaker Marlon Riggs, who died this week of AIDS. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Rwanda's capital, Kigali, is in chaos for a second day after the assassination of its president and the leader of neighboring Burundi. Fighting between government forces, opposition groups, and angry citizens have killed many people, including officials, UN peacekeepers, and Catholic clergy. NPR's Michael Scholar reports.
The assassination has set fire once again to the long-present ethnic power struggle between the Hutus and Tutsis, though it's still not certain who murdered the Hutu president. Residents of Kigali say fighting is everywhere, and no one has ventured to guess how many people have died so far. The Tutsi Rwandan Patriotic Front is in control of the parliament building as they fight with government troops. Some gangs are reportedly going house to house on killing sprees. 10 Belgian soldiers assigned to a UN peacekeeping force were killed trying to save Rwanda's prime minister, a Tutsi, who was also murdered. Other UN troops are dead as well. 19 Catholic nuns and priests were killed at a Jesuit center, and foreign governments are discussing whether to evacuate their citizens who live in Kigali. This is Michael Scholar reporting.
Israeli soldiers shot and wounded at least 25 Palestinians in Hebron during a visit there today by civil rights leader Jesse Jackson. NPR's Paul Miller reports from Jerusalem.
Jesse Jackson went to Hebron on a mission of peace. He quickly experienced the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. A crowd gathered to hear him speak, stones were thrown, and Israeli soldiers opened fire. Witnesses said Palestinians were wounded by live ammunition and rubber bullets in the disturbances. Jackson was not hurt. Jackson, who made a controversial visit here in 1979 when Prime Minister Menachem Begin refused to meet with him, has had his difficulties with Israeli authorities on this visit, too. His bus was held up for 3 hours on the way to Hebron in a dispute over security arrangements, and the Israelis have decided a conference Jackson was invited to attend in honor of the PLO's 30th anniversary cannot be held in Hebron or in East Jerusalem. I'm Paul Miller in Jerusalem.
National Public Radio has learned that some chemicals that the government won't put in food are in cigarettes. There are more than 700 chemicals in cigarettes. NPR has the names of 13. Five are listed as hazardous by the federal government. One has been found to promote convulsions in animals. Another is ammonia, which irritates the eyes, skin, and respiratory tract. A toxicologist who consults for the tobacco industry has told NPR all the chemical additives are safe at the levels found in cigarettes. Rock singer Kurt Cobain of the group Nirvana has shot himself to death at his Seattle home. Police say his body was discovered with a shotgun wound to the head and a suicide note nearby. He was recovering from an overdose last month of painkillers and alcohol. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 17 points at 3676. This is NPR. The Croatian ambassador to the United States is calling for international help in rebuilding his country. He wants to prevent the spread of fighting in other parts of the former Yugoslavia. NPR's Carol Ann Clark-Kelly reports.
Ambassador Petar Sarcevic says there have been plenty of words of goodwill, but too few concrete proposals for rebuilding things like roads and energy pipelines destroyed during ethnic fighting in his country. The Croatian ambassador also believes the international community must do more to prevent Serb attacks on the Bosnian Muslim enclave of Garajda. Sarcevic says the fighting there poses a threat to the newly signed peace agreement between Bosnian Croats and Muslims.
It would be necessary to strengthen strengthen the presence, international presence in Gorazde, and in that way also to save that part of the country from further destruction.
The Croatian ambassador worries the continued fighting in Bosnia will create a new flood of refugees. He says his country is already struggling to deal with 500,000 refugees and displaced persons. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
The Associated Press is quoting Iraqi dissidents who say two bombs exploded near government ministries in Baghdad this week, but the Iraqi news agency hasn't mentioned anything. The Iraqi National Congress says one bomb went off 100 yards from the industry ministry in the central part of the city. Another blew up near the agriculture ministry. Both blasts came on Wednesday. The dissidents say the blasts underscore the growing discontent with the government because of hardship stemming from the international trade embargo on Iraq. North Korea is warning that pressure on it to open up its nuclear facilities to inspection could trigger a war at any time. A North Korean government minister is blaming the West for the pressure. Tension has grown on the divided Korean peninsula after North Korea refused to allow full international inspection of its nuclear sites. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're featuring writers on this archive edition of our show. A review in the New York Times described my guest, poet Philip Levine, as a large, ironic Whitman of the industrial heartland, loyal to his roots in Detroit, determined to remember the exhausted and enraged worker, the unlucky immigrant, the man who gasps for breath and asks, "Am I going to make it?" Philip Levine worked in many factories in Detroit as a young man. Now work means writing, but the sweat and fire of factory work continue to be the subject of some of his most compelling poems. Levine has a new memoir called The Bread of Time. I spoke with him in 1991 after the publication of his poetry collection called What Work Is. I asked him why work has been such an important theme in his poems, and he told me about the impact of working in automobile assembly factories.
It's a very exotic place, or it was when I was very young. There was fire, there was noise, it was like bedlam. Sometimes I remember going into a foundry once to get a job, and I was about 17. They wouldn't hire me. I was too young, and thinking, really, I'm in hell.
Yeah,
this is like hell. You know, it was so hot, and it was this liquid metal, and I was terrified. I was glad they wouldn't hire me.
I want you to read the title poem from your new collection, What Work Is. And is there a story you'd like us to hear about the poem before we hear the poem itself?
Yeah, there is. There's a curious story. I never worked at Ford Highland Park, which I mentioned in the poem. But I went there once for a job during a period in the early 50s in Detroit, when there was a slight recession, so a lot of people got laid off, although Detroit was a booming town back then. And I waited in line, and it was raining, and it was a long wait. You know, the newspaper would advertise, you know, assemblers. That's the lowest job you can get. And they would put hours down, like 8 to 5. But you knew you had to be there early if you were going to get a job. And so you got there maybe 7:30. Well, they didn't open the employment office till, say, 9. So you stood there for an hour and a half before anything even opened, and there were 50 people ahead of you. But that was in a way to, you know, they wanted to test you. You know, how much crap could you take? I mean, were you willing to wait in line that long? If you weren't, they didn't want you. And so as I waited, I grew angrier and angrier at myself for being this humble character. And finally, maybe about 10:30 or so, I got up to the head of the line. And there was a guy sitting down. I was standing. We each went to a different desk. We stood, they sat. And he said, "What kind of job would you like?" And I don't know where this impulse came from, but I said, "I want your job."
Oh, gee.
And he said, "Okay, take off." And that was it. But I was sort of happy that there was this thing in me that was still there that, you know, said, you know, I don't want you and you don't want me. And so I suppose that I never forgot that moment of standing there all that time and then being, you know, a smart mouth.
Did you have the money to afford to mouth off like that and lose the pay for the day?
No. No, I didn't. I remember I went to Chevrolet Gear and Axle, which was an awful place, later that day, and got another got a job there, which was just as bad. You know, it was just as bad a place. I was married at the time. I had to make a living. I had responsibilities. So I mean, I really couldn't afford to be who I wanted to be. You know? Let me read the poem. What work is? We stand in the rain in a long line, waiting at Ford Highland Park for work. You know what work is. If you're old enough to read this, you know what work is, although you may not do it. Forget you. This is about waiting, shifting from one foot to another, feeling the light rain falling like mist into your hair, blurring your vision, until you think you see your own brother ahead of you, maybe 10 places. You rub your glasses with your fingers, and of course it's someone else's brother, narrower across the shoulders than yours, but with the same sad slouch, the grin that does not hide the stubbornness, the sad refusal to give in to rain, to the hours wasted waiting, to the knowledge that somewhere ahead, a man is waiting who will say, "No, we're not hiring today, for any reason he wants." You love your brother. Now suddenly you can hardly stand the love flooding you for your brother, who's not beside you or behind or ahead, because he's home, trying to sleep off a miserable night shift at Cadillac, so he can get up before noon to study his German. Works 8 hours a night so he can sing Wagner, the opera you hate most, the worst music ever invented. How long has it been since you told him you loved him, held his wide shoulders, opened your eyes wide and said those words, and maybe kissed his cheek? You've never done something so simple, so obvious. Not because you're too young or too dumb. Not because you're jealous or even mean or incapable of crying in the presence of another man. No, just because you don't know what work is.
When did you start writing about your experiences in factories? Were you still in factories when you were writing poems?
I was unable to write any poetry about my working life while that was my working life. I tried a few times, and the poems were hysterical. I think they were just, you know, I couldn't control them. My anger was so overwhelming that I couldn't cope with it. Just as I couldn't write about my boyhood very effectively, until I was, 40. It was still too powerful for me. But I'm patient, so I hung in there, and that's probably my chief virtue as a writer, is my patience. So I waited, and I kept trying to write about factory work, but I kept throwing the poems away. And the first poem I ever published about working in a factory, I was, 31 or 2. But I don't like the poem anymore.
Can you give me a sense of what was going wrong in the factory poems when you were still there? Is there anything?
Yes, okay. Yes, I can. The language was overblown. I wanted to use the word eternity, and you know, I wanted to use a kind of Latin diction, almost a Miltonic diction, and a great chorus. Build up a great chorus of sound and to dramatize the horror show of some of the places I'd worked. And I didn't have any, there was no tenderness in it for the people that I worked with. There was no, and that was a, you know, That was part of the reward that I got for those years, was the people I was meeting, even though you didn't talk to them that much because the places were often so loud. But you'd meet them afterwards, or you'd make friends with them and spend time with them. And they weren't getting in the poems at all. The poems were, my poor soul being hammered out of shape by General Motors. And they were a bit self-indulgent.
Poet Philip Levine is my guest. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with poet Philip Levine. What was your final goodbye to factory work?
My final goodbye was, it came when my first wife left me, which is why I always love the word goodbye. And I didn't have to do this. Also, I wasn't in debt, and it just suddenly occurred to me, she's gone. I don't owe anybody anything. I'm going to quit. I'm going to live on my wits, or try. And so I started to try to live on my wits, and sure enough, I've done it.
So what did
not
that?
Not too well all the time, but you know.
When you decided to live on your wits, where did you go? What did you do for money?
Well, actually, I took a job with my brother. I don't want to describe it because he'd get mad at me. And for a long summer, and I could live like a little church mouse. And then I went off to the University of Iowa to study poetry writing with Robert Lowell. And I thought there was a fellowship there for me. And when I got there, I was a year late, and the fellowship had been given to somebody else, even though I'd written them and said, hold it for me. And so I never registered. I just took courses without paying for them and kept saying, oh, that information will get to you soon. And I studied with Robert Lowell and then John Berryman. And John Berryman was a great teacher, just a great teacher. And I never needed another teacher after that. So I had a year of studying with two terrific poets.
You've written a lot of poems that, where your brother figures into the poem?
Yeah.
Do you see your brother as like the alternate version of your life or something? You know, like somebody who you could have been and you're not? Or, I mean, like what function do you see your brother as serving almost as metaphor or something within your poems?
Yeah, first thing, I'm an identical twin.
Ah.
And I didn't realize how significant this was in my poetry. I have a great many poems in which men have these encounters with each other and a couple of poems in which they embrace very deeply, they hold each other. And I think that a lot of that, I remember a guy writing, a wonderful man named David Calstone, who's dead now, writing a review of one of my books and talking about these encounters and how powerful they were or how powerful he felt they were. And it was that review that opened my eyes to the fact that, of course, the roots of that are the terrible wrenching away from my twin brother. I grew up half believing I was half a person. It's very curious to grow up as an identical twin. Not sure that I was the whole person. Maybe I was. Me and him both, or me, it's very difficult to describe, but I don't think since I was five I've ever felt that anything as close as I'd felt up to that time, maybe six or seven when we began to drift apart, and I remember when I first started writing poetry, it was enormously. I was about Well, actually, I didn't show my brother the first poems I wrote. I didn't show him poems until I was about 17 or so. And he loved them. He just loved them. And he would take, he's a bigger guy than I, and he's more aggressive physically and in every other way. And he would take these poems and show them to people and say, what do you think? Isn't this great? That's what he would say. Isn't this great? And of course they'd say, yeah, because he was kind of an intimidating guy. My brother's a great poet. And in some ways, it was the high point of my writing career. I mean, I had one reader, and he was absolutely mad for what I was doing. Now I have many more readers, but I don't know if any of them, you know, are so totally, totally taken with what I write. I was really writing totally for two people, myself and my brother. Since then, I've discovered others, but it was quite amazing.
You said that you were wrenched away from your twin brother. When were you wrenched away?
I was afraid you'd ask that. I just felt at a certain point in my life that when I was quite young, that I had to be myself. I began to make discoveries about him, that he wasn't me. There were ways in which he reacted to experiences. I could see that it was they just weren't my reactions. And so a time came when I said, I can't go on with this. I have to find out my own identity and live it. And so I suppose the wrenching was something I imposed upon myself. My guess is he probably felt something similar. I do think there were times when our inmost thoughts were communicated to each other without our speaking. We were that close.
How close are you now?
I'd rather not talk about that.
That's fine, okay. Does he still read your poems?
I don't know. I would hope so.
I want to get back to something you said early in the interview.
Sure.
You said that, then this is when you were, you know, waiting online for factory jobs and knowing that you might get turned down. You said you couldn't afford to be who you wanted to be. And I think within that sentence is a pretty interesting class analysis about identity. You know what I mean? That it takes a certain amount of money in a way to live, not only to live the life you want, but to be who you want to be.
That's right. I mean, for example, I was politically very conscious. I was aware of exploitation. I remember my brother and I at about age 10 swearing, we would never exploit other people. We would never live off the labor of other people, you know, in a way in which they were abused and we were given an advantage on their hard work. And I remember when I worked at for a General Motors factory once, you had to take these IQ tests before you started working. And they said, you know, we'd like to put you into our management program. You've done very well on this IQ test. I lied and said I'd never gone to college or they'd never hire you. And they said, gee, these scores are wonderful. And I said, no. And they said, we would send you to Flint, Michigan. You go to a school there. You know, we have a slavery school there. You know, you'll be taught really how to torture people effectively and subtly. And we'll pay you twice as much. And when you're done, we'll give you a suit and a tie. Wouldn't you like to do that? And I said, no, I just like to be a slave myself. I mean, I didn't like being a slave, but I had taken an oath that I wasn't going to exploit people. And my brother was watching me. I couldn't break it. He's a very stubborn guy. So it was a determination we made. It would be nice to be able to afford it. Of course, then what do you have to do? You have to change the world so that lots of people can take that oath and live it, right? And how did I choose to change the world so that was more possible? I wrote poetry. And I actually thought, and this will strike you, Terry, as idiotic.
I actually thought that
writing poetry would be a means of changing the world. Because what I was reading was changing me so radically. Nothing in my life had as much power over me as what I read.
Philip Levine, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's nice. It's a pleasure.
Philip Levine has a new memoir called The Bread of Time. Our interview was recorded in 1991 after the publication of his collection of poems, What Work Is. This Sunday, CBS presents a telemovie called David's Mother, which Bob Randall adapted from his play of the same name. It's about a woman whose devotion to her teenaged autistic son borders on the obsessive, and it stars Kirstie Alley, formerly of Cheers, in the title role. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
You might not expect much out of a movie starring Kirstie Alley, especially if you've seen stuff like Look Who's Talking. But if you watch her play Sally in David's Mother on Sunday, chances are you'll be talking about her and the telemovie the next morning. What she does, what the whole movie does, is special. Every performance in David's Mother, every scene, almost every line, feels real. Sometimes too real. Even its sense of humor is raw. One of the ways Sally deals with her son's condition is to joke about it. To him, to herself, and to the few people who enter their lives. Her jokes are funny, but sometimes you'll be laughing in spite of yourself, because they aren't exactly politically correct. Here she is introducing her son to a gentleman caller, played beautifully by Sam Waterston.
John, I want you to meet my son. This is David, the one you've heard so much about. Come on, David, be polite, shake hands. John is speechless. He didn't think you were so handsome, probably.
I'm sorry.
Oh, no, don't sweat it. You know, most people don't expect David to be so handsome. How about Pinocchio, honey? You haven't seen that in a couple of days. Ow, don't bite. He loves Pinocchio. Up to the part where the boys turn into donkeys. And then that is just a little too close to home, you know what I mean?
Sally uses the same sense of humor when dealing with her sister B, played by Stockard Channing.
I got a letter from Susan.
Susan who?
Susan, your daughter, Susan. She's pregnant.
What? She's only 18.
She's 19.
Already? Did she happen to mention whether or not she's married?
She's getting married in a few weeks.
I like that. First things first.
Why don't you call her?
Nah. I call her, she'll probably miscarry.
David's mother slides in and out of flashbacks, showing how Sally and David became so interdependent over the years. We see Chris Sarandon as David's father, eventually driven away by his wife's constant attention to their autistic son. In the past, we see Sally fighting with her daughter, husband, and sister. In the present, we see her alone with David, joking, as always, but clearly not very happy. Michael Gourgian plays David as a 16-year-old.
Come on, sweetie, kids tell jokes all the time. You know this joke? Why did the moron tiptoe past the medicine cabinet? Because he didn't want to wake up the sleeping pills. Oh, come on, sweetie, tell me a joke. David. Out of all the kids in the whole world, you ought to know a few moron jokes. Tell me a joke, David.
Stockard Channing and Sam Waterston, as the loved ones who pull Sally out of her self-imposed isolation, are just wonderful. You don't see characters or acting this credible on TV, or anywhere else, that often. And Kirstie Alley, at the center of almost every scene, delivers the performance of her career.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Thank you. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Writer Grace Paley has said art is too long and life is too short to explain why her body of work isn't larger. Now her three volumes of short stories have been collected in one book. Coming up on this archive edition of Fresh Air, Grace Paley reads a poem and reflects on her life. Also, Kurt Vonnegut remembers the night in a Dresden slaughterhouse, which was the basis of his classic anti-war novel, Slaughterhouse-Five. A 25th anniversary edition has just been published. And we remember Marlon Riggs, whose award-winning film, Tongues Untied, was about being black and gay in America. It was the subject of controversy in Congress and the public broadcasting system. Riggs died Tuesday of AIDS. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Teamsters union leaders are meeting in Washington to talk about going on with their strike against 22 freight companies. The walkout is 3 days old. Police in Columbus, Ohio, have arrested more than 30 pickets on disorderly conduct charges. Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio reports.
Here in Columbus alone, there were two separate incidents on the picket lines just this morning. At CF Motor Freight, 15 union activists were arrested and charged with disorderly conduct after they allegedly blocked a truck that was trying to leave the terminal. Meanwhile, at Roadway Trucking Company, it was the same story. This time, 17 pickets were charged with blocking trucks. 22 freight companies are the target of the strike. Some have gone to court and gotten restraining orders that limit union picketing and harassment. But the orders, in some cases, are being violated. Union officials are angry over the companies wanting to use part-time workers at the loading docks. One union official says, while full-time Teamsters on those jobs earn about $17 an hour, the part-timers may be paid as little as $9. For National Public Radio, this is Bill Cohen in Columbus.
An Orthodox rabbi has been convicted in Los Angeles of conspiracy to launder millions of dollars of drug money. Rabbi Abraham Lowe intended to use a holy network of charities to accomplish this. He faces a maximum of 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. A federal jury deadlocked on two other charges against him of money laundering and six more of bank fraud. Some evidence against Lowe included videotapes of meeting between him and an FBI agent posing as a drug dealer. The United Nations peacekeeping commander in Bosnia is trying to get the Bosnian government and the Bosnian Serbs to the negotiating table. General Michael Rose wants both sides to extend their ceasefire. He has been meeting separately with both sides. The BBC's Bob Simpson reports.
The general's diplomacy for the day started with meetings in Sarajevo. He saw the American special envoy, Charles Redman, before launching into an afternoon of commuting between the city and the Serb military base at Lukovica. He'll be trying to exploit the goodwill demonstrated by both sides declaring unilateral 24-hour ceasefires, which run out this evening. His work will be reinforced by the head of the United Nations operation in the former Yugoslavia, Yasushi Akashi, who contributed to progress yesterday, keeping in touch with both sides by telephone from his headquarters in Zagreb. The two UN figures will be working towards getting signatures on the draft ceasefire document left overnight for the protagonists to reflect upon. As for the ceasefire itself, the UN military spokesman said it was not a real ceasefire. There was shelling and firing at various points of tension, he reported.
Bob Simpson reporting. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials dropped 20 points to close at 3,674. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. Three Federal Express workers are in serious condition after a fight aboard a company plane in flight yesterday. Memphis, Tennessee authorities say one worker attacked his colleagues with a hammer and spear gun yesterday. The pilot managed to land the plane safely back in Memphis after crew members subdued the attacker. It's not clear why the worker attacked the others, but the Commercial Appeal newspaper reports the man was supposed to face a disciplinary hearing today for allegedly faking his work credentials. The FBI says the attacker was an off-duty FedEx pilot. He's been charged with the attack and endangering an aircraft in flight. China has detained another veteran dissident. This new detention marks an increasingly tough line by Beijing against its dissident community. Meanwhile, debate rages with Washington over the link between human rights and Beijing's most favored nation trading status. Matt Forney reports from Beijing.
Beijing released Xu Enli nearly a year ago as it tried to soft-pedal human rights during the debate over MFN. This year it's detained him and other dissidents, also as the MFN decision nears. China seems bent on driving a wedge between trade and human rights. This weekend, a ministry-level delegation will visit Washington to promote lucrative energy contracts. Later, a foreign trade ministry delegation is expected to order several $100 million of U.S. goods, but at the same time demand that trade and human rights be delinked. As far as Chinese leaders are concerned, if Washington okays its MFN status at the same time that police lock away prominent dissidents, that means Washington accepts the Chinese view that human rights is strictly an internal matter. For National Public Radio, I'm Matt Forney in Beijing.
Edison, New Jersey authorities say natural gas could be flowing through a repaired pipeline in the city next Monday. The interstate pipeline has been out of service since a blast devastated 8 apartment buildings 2 weeks ago. Officials say a high-pressure test of the line yesterday was a complete success. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. There's a new 25th anniversary edition of Kurt Vonnegut's anti-war novel Slaughterhouse-Five. So on this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're going to listen back to an interview I recorded with Vonnegut in 1986. His other novels include Cat's Cradle, The Sirens of Titan, Breakfast of Champions, and Dead-Eyed Dick. Vonnegut is in many ways a paradoxical writer. He writes comic novels about despair, and he's an atheist who's obsessed with all the questions about life that religion responds to. Slaughterhouse-Five is based on his World War II experiences as a prisoner of war in Dresden, Germany, during the bombing of the city. He told me how he survived the bombing and the firestorms in Dresden.
Well, it was merely a matter of luck, as there were no air raid shelters in Dresden because an air raid was not expected. The Germans had believed it to be an open city. There, in fact, is no convention in war. I guess there wasn't medieval times, but they did not expect an attack, and there didn't seem to be any strong reason to attack it, so there were no air raid shelters. And it was a beautiful city like Vienna or Budapest, or Prague, and one night, as the British came over, they're the ones who did the firebombing, really, the Americans dropped the high explosives, but the whole city was burned down, and all there was to hide in was cellars, and we happened to be quartered, our work crew of American prisoners of war was quartered in a slaughterhouse. One thing, there weren't many buildings around, there were just a few large buildings. So the firestorm wasn't very intense there. Also, we were in a meat locker way under the street, so it would have been the place for Hitler to be, anybody to be. It was the safest place in Dresden, accidentally. So that's how I survived.
And then when the bombing was over, you had to go upstairs and dig out corpses.
Well, what we did first was the city had to cool off before we could walk around. It was like a volcano or something like that. You had to wait for the lava to cool off. But we stayed down for quite a while, I forget how long, and finally came back up. And then we had to walk and walk and walk until we could find someplace else to stay. There was nobody to lead us. I mean, we just had guards who were corporals and privates and sergeants, and they didn't know where the hell to go, and there was nobody for them to ask. So they marched us out on the edge of town and found us a place to stay out there. But then the city began to get organized, what was left of it and all that, and we were organized into work crews to go in and dig bodies out from underneath the street. And I have... I have looked at movies of the liberation of concentration camps in Germany, where the SS was made to carry the corpses to the lime pits or to the graves or whatever, while a whole lot of people watched. And the moral situation isn't analogous at all, but the political situation is I have carried corpses while civilians watched and thought it served me right to be carrying corpses.
What do you mean?
Because I was an American and the corpses had been created by Americans and British.
Did the bombing and the stench of the bodies that you were digging up afterwards haunt you? Did those memories
no,
haunt you for years?
If you were imagining it, as yes, of course it would, and that would, and so the person would be colored for the rest of his life by this stench in his nostrils and all that. This was a wonderful teenage adventure in my life. I wouldn't have missed a moment of it. It did not wound me at all. Things that happened when I was 6 years old will go a whole lot. Will explain far more thoroughly what I am than Dresden. No, it was a great adventure. I loved the whole damn thing.
You really did.
Oh yeah, and I liked being in the infantry. I wouldn't have missed it.
I'm just so surprised to hear that.
Well, it's wrong for a pacifist to like war that much, but I found nothing to object to.
I guess it's part of being young.
Yeah.
For you. When did you realize you were going to write about it? Was it then or years later?
I felt that it just kept nagging at me. It took me a while to realize that this was an important historical event, and it turns out to have been the largest massacre in European history. Now, massacre is something that happened suddenly. As heaven knows, Auschwitz killed many, many more people, but slowly, you know, in an industrial manner. And in just one big whoosh of killing a whole lot of people suddenly, Dresden held the record, and I had been there. And so I decided, I'd better write about this, because I was a professional writer, and I'm always casting about for what to write about next. It took me a long time to do.
Did the writing about it change the way you remembered it? Did it bring back memories that you hadn't remembered, you know, things that you hadn't remembered? Or did you see it through a different filter because you were older then and had experienced more?
Well, I wrote, well, for one thing, I had one of the filters I'd seen it through was war movies about World War II. And war books. And, of course, they featured Frank Sinatra and Duke Wayne and all that. And it took me a long time to realize that this war was, in fact, fought by children, you know, and not these middle-aged 4F movie actors. And so that's what one thing made the book bizarre, that, in fact, the infantrymen were teenagers, which is not usual in an American war story.
You've joked that you're not only one of the few survivors of that bombing, but you're the only person to have made a profit from it, because through royalties for your book, you've made about $3 per person killed in Dresden. And I was wondering if you had ever experienced what's sometimes called survivor's guilt.
Probably in some other situations, not the Dresden situation. I did lose several friends. There were 100 of us in that prisoner of war camp, a little labor gang in Dresden, and 5% of us died, didn't make it back home for one reason or another. That's not enough to give you survivor's guilt, I guess. I will issue the challenge again here, because the people have... A lot of people get mad at me for having talked about the destruction of a Nazi city, you know, and I saw it, which is the reason I wrote about it, and there's no reason for me to keep it secret that I saw it. But another thing is that absolutely nothing was gained by it, and I'll issue the challenge again here, that nobody in this whole world benefited from that air raid but me. that not one person got out of Auschwitz a microsecond earlier. Not one German soldier fell back from his foxhole on the Russian front or the American front. Nothing was changed at all. And that I'm the only person who benefited, and I get $3 and maybe $4 for each person killed there. And so this is going out over radio. I've done it on BBC and so forth. And that first letter has yet to float in. It's, hey, if it weren't for Dresden, whatever.
Kurt Vonnegut, recorded in 1986. There's a new 25th anniversary edition of his novel Slaughterhouse-Five. We'll hear from writer Grace Paley after this break. This is Fresh Air. When Grace Paley was named New York's first official state writer in 1986, she said the only thing nicer might be if she got an award from her block. Well, that'll give you a sense of what she writes about, the people from the neighborhood. Her neighborhoods have been the Bronx, where she grew up, Greenwich Village, where she raised her children, and Vermont, where she now lives. Vermont is a surprising place for the writer Ann Tyler once described as urban to an unusual degree. Paley is a longtime peace and women's rights advocate. She's best known for her three volumes of short stories, which have just been collected in one book called The Collected Stories. Paley wrote poems even before she wrote stories. When I spoke with her in 1992, she read one of her poems.
Thank God for the old Jewish ladies. Though their sons are splendid with houses and brilliant from college, they take our leaflets. Sometimes they say, "Pishers, what's on your mind? Don't get excited. Hitler is dead. Where are the sweatshops?" Then we say, "Missus, did you forget Vietnam? I won't speak about Israel. Turn around maybe 80 degrees. You'll see a few sweatshops. Not to mention imperialism's furnace, the nation of Africa." They answer, "Of course. Oh, yes, as usual, we heard it before. Naturally. Ah, the poor people are dying, dying, dying. Foolish girl, listen, you'll never stop at the dying from killing." Then we tell them, only five words. "So, why did you live?" "Uh-oh, a fresh mouth. But, darling, you're right. In your life, you shouldn't give up the ship. So long you got strength. Maybe this world wouldn't turn out a total disaster."
I like that poem a lot. Did you feel that in their own way, the older people in the neighborhood were encouraging to you?
They were. And it's true. I mean, I actually wrote this fairly recently, so I'm just about as old as they are. But what I was feeling very much was when you stand on a street corner and give out leaflets, a lot of people don't take them. You know, and you begin to see who's taking them, who's not taking them, and you begin to develop theories and ideas, most of which are false. But in this case, I noticed that these old ladies, old Jewish ladies like me, were taking the leaflets.
Tell me why you've always had an affinity as a writer for describing people like that.
Well, I really do describe really lots of other kinds of people, but I think mostly in my first book, I think I had to go and deal with my own family and think about how they had come and lived on this American earth. An example would be that I'm very interested in and have written a poem and some stories even about an uncle of mine who was deported during the Palmer raids in the 1920s and early 1920s or late 19s, and my family never talked about him. And it's something that has perplexed me, and I don't understand it. So, you really write about what you don't understand, you know. So I'm up to not understanding that right now.
No, you said you were curious. You wanted to kind of find out more about the mysteries of how your parents came here. There's actually a really interesting story behind some of that that I'd like for you to tell, you know, about how the Tsar let political prisoners
off. Oh, yeah, right. You know that story, right. I must. What happened was that my parents in Russia were political people, were socialists, and very active and very young also. They must have been 19, 20 years old. And my father was imprisoned and sent to Arkhangelsk, really. And my mother was sent into exile. And then the Tsar Nicholas, had a son. And when he had a son, he pardoned everybody under 21. And in this way, my parents were pardoned. My father was pardoned. My mother came back from Germany. And they got on a boat pretty fast and came to the United States.
Grace Paley recorded in 1992. Her three volumes of short stories have been collected in a new book called Grace Paley, The Collected Stories. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, earlier today, NPR reported about secret ingredients, secret chemicals in cigarettes. Will you have more on that on All Things Considered?
We will. We'll be hearing again from Rebecca Pearl, and anyone who missed reports this morning should tune in to hear it on our program. In addition, we'll be hearing from Sylvia Poggioli today about the completion of the restoration of the Sistine Chapel. This is has been greeted with great ceremony at the Vatican. We'll also be hearing from an American art historian, the founder of ArtWatch, who says that this particular restoration, like others, actually has destroyed an authentic work of art and replaced it with a modern reproduction.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In Marlon Riggs' controversial documentary, Tongues Untied, he mentioned he was HIV positive. Earlier this week, Riggs died of AIDS. Tongues Untied was about the central issue in Riggs' life, the double marginalization of being black and gay. The film contained nudity, scenes of men kissing, profanity, and the racial and sexual slurs which he had been subjected to. This made the film the subject of a funding controversy in Congress. Some PBS stations refused to air the movie when it was featured on the POV series. Riggs' more recent film, Color Adjustment, about stereotypes of blacks in movies, won a Peabody Award. Riggs was 37. We remember him now with an excerpt of our 1991 interview. He said in Tongues Untied that when he came out, there were no gay black images in books, movies, posters, or even in his own fantasies. I asked about how that void affected him.
That effect was one of making me feel extremely isolated, as if I was the only one in the world, that made me feel that I myself was unworthy of love, that I had nothing that I could offer because in gay society there was nothing that affirmed who I was as a black man. That is, in gay society, all of the icons of beauty, of excellence, of virtue were white. And of course, in black American society, I had no icons that I could look up to, and that everyone worthy of emulation within the black community was resolutely heterosexual, according to the myth. So that for someone who was black and gay and looking for some form of affirmation in larger social life for who they were, who I am, there was nothing there.
You know, in talking about how white you found the gay community to be after you came out, I'm wondering if occasionally the opposite wasn't true, and I'm thinking that for a lot of politicized social movements, there's this almost fear of being perceived as a white middle class movement, and I think for some of the movements, and I'd include in this the feminist movement, that for blacks who enter the movement, they're so welcome because it's a sign of what people want to be true, that it's not just a white movement.
But what happens that even when one is welcome as a black person, whether one is a black female feminist or a black gay man, when you are welcome into that larger white society, you're welcomed on the terms of that society, not on your own terms.
And how are those two terms different for you? Yeah.
So, for instance, I can go into the Castro to a certain degree if I'm willing to play by the game and dress in the way that white gay men dress, read the books that white gay men read, not discuss issues of race, not bring those kinds of issues up, not discuss the issues and problems of the African-American community when I talk about liberation. If I am willing to subscribe to these narrow notions of liberation that just address sexuality, and if I'm willing to abide by these roles that many white gay men see me as, and that is this super sex stud, with not much intelligence that's really worth addressing a reckoning with, then I will be welcome. I will be accepted.
Now, you felt, as you stated in the movie, that there's also been a lot of trouble for black homosexuals like yourself to get accepted within black political movements.
Yes, within black society at large, not just politics.
What kinds of places have you been made to feel unwelcome as a man who is out and who sees homosexuality as a political and social issue? Do you know what I mean? I mean, the right to be who you are as being a political social issue.
I mean, there's so many areas of life, but personally, I think because of the nature of my work, which is cultural, I'm a documentary maker.
Yeah.
And of course, you constantly hear within black society, within African American society and communities, about the need for so-called positive images. The need to redress the wrongs of historic omission in the media culture and the popular culture of America. So that when I start to treat those kinds of issues, as long as I present images that affirm a heterosexist point of view, that is, in which all of the so-called role models are wonderful black family in the most traditional sense, heterosexual people, then I am fine. The moment that I try to introduce issues of sexual difference into that equation, then I'm suddenly betraying the need for positive images and presenting, in fact, the opposite.
One of the things you reveal about yourself in the movie is that you've tested HIV positive. Did you know that when you started the movie, or is that something
Yes.
you found out as you were making it?
No, I knew that before starting it. In fact, it was a major catalyst to my making this movie, and to making it uncompromising and searing and honest in the language and the so-called graphic depictions of our imagery, and also in the quite honest and brutal analysis of racism and homophobia and self-hatred. And I mean self-hatred on the part of black gay men themselves in our society.
Filmmaker Marlon Riggs recorded in 1991. He died Tuesday of AIDS. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's baseball season again. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with former first baseman Keith Hernandez about his illustrious career and his relationship to his father, who played in the minor leagues. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.